Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am David James Gonzalez, the producer and host of today's podcast, and I'm pleased to have Ronald Reyer with me to discuss his book, Border Wall as Architecture, a Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary, published by the University of California Press in 2017. Professor Reyer holds the Eva Lai Memorial Chair in Architecture and a joint appointment in the Department of Architecture, in the College of Environmental Design, and the Department of Art Practice at the University of California, Berkeley. He is both a Bakar and Hellman Fellow, director of the Master's Architecture Program, and founded the Print Farm Laboratory. He is an applied architectural researcher, design activist, author, and thought leader in the fields of additive manufacturing and earthen architecture. Hello, Ronald, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Thank you for having me, David.
Great. Well, I'm excited about our conversation today and was hoping you could just begin by taking a few minutes to tell us a little bit about your personal and professional background.
Sure. As you mentioned, I'm a professor at UC Berkeley in the Department of Architecture and Art Practice, but I'm also a trained architect and designer, and so I have a practice outside of that that looks at speculative ways of thinking about the world through the lens of architecture and design and art. And my own personal background is I grew up in Southern Colorado in what was the borderlands of the U.S. and Mexico prior to 1848. And my family would have been on the Mexican side of that border in the northernmost frontier. So this was called the San Luis Valley. Mm-hmm. And it was right below the Arkansas River at the northernmost stretch of that pass, on which the other side, of course, was the United States. So I feel in many ways my interest in the borderlands or the topic of the border wall today comes from the fact that I lived and grew up and my family lived and grew up in a landscape that was very much affected by being part of a borderlands experience at one point in history. And I think those that borderlands phenomena still remains even to this date in that region.
Uh-huh. Definitely. Thanks for that. And what I'd like you to do next, if you would, is tell us a little bit about how this project came together.
Sure. Well, the book of Border Walls Architecture came together. I could say that it started back in 1999 when I was looking at architecture made out of earth. Traditional earthen architecture, adobe, is what we might know most in the Southwest. But I would take students on journeys through the Southwest to look at the traditional architecture, and we'd even cross over into Mexico and extend that journey into that landscape, recognizing that that was really it's a very artificial boundary. It's just a continuity of migration and settlement patterns that have been existed in this landscape for thousands of years. It was around 2004 when I began working on some art projects, one which is well known called Prada Marfa, which I worked on with two artists from Berlin. And that project, which was only, it's about 30 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border, on a desolate road in the middle of the Chihuahuan Desert in West Texas. This project, Pradamarfa, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a building that looks like a Prada store. It has the 2004 line of shoes and purses in it. It's not accessible. It's not a store. But it's a bit of a thought piece about the politics and relationships between United States and Mexico, between wealth and poverty, between high fashion and art and local vernaculars. And so it's a structure, it's a building that talks about that. And I think at that point in 2004, it's at that point when the United States government is beginning to heighten their security measures on the southern border as a reaction to 9/11. 2 years after this project is the passing of the Secure Fence Act of 2006 that mandated 800 miles of wall to be constructed on the southern border. And I became very interested in, because I was working there at the time, I continued to have projects there in the region, to see the importation of enormous amounts of steel, like you might see in a urban construction site for a skyscraper, moving into that landscape, seeing the walls constructed, and recognizing the consequences of that wall on the ecology, the humanitarian consequences, and especially the phenomenons that begin to occur that were not really thought through, not only in terms of how it performed, but how nature and people would respond to the wall in a very physical and tactile way. And so I became interested in recording these stories, remembering these stories and writing them down, but also as a designer, begin to think about how does an architect participate in this conversation, particularly an architect who's not in support of that kind of construction along the southern border. So this is how that project was born. It was born 12 years ago and more by just being there at a very particular period of time when this happened. And so what's always been fascinating to me about the current rhetoric is that, you know, when Trump began campaigning a couple of years ago for president, he said, "I'm going to build a wall," and audiences would say, "Yeah, finally someone's come along to build a wall."
Right.
But yet there's nearly 700 miles of wall constructed, and it continues to be constructed through several administrations. And not too many people raise an eyebrow. And that's also something that I found strange and interesting. Like, why? So the reaction now is maybe fueled by the visibility of a project that has not yet happened, which is Trump's version of the border wall, and maybe the invisibility of a project that has been ongoing for many years now, since almost 12 years, and what that means, you know, to think about the meaning of this wall, a proposed wall, a wall in existence, and also the history of that fluctuating border between the United States and Mexico, and the migration of animals and people and weather and everything that's kind of crossed that landscape over time. And so, you know, it's just such a fascinating and never-ending body of knowledge to be drawn from that landscape.
Yes, you know, and it is, you know, such a paradox, I think, of, you know, recent, and when I say recent, I mean, I'm a historian, right? So I'm really thinking like maybe the last half century or so of American politics, just how much of an issue, you know, immigration has been, you know, the security of the border, and it's, you know, it's built, it's ebbed, it's flowed, it's changed. But for me, that it strikes me is, you know, if you grew up in the Southwest, as you've mentioned, and much of my childhood was in San Diego, very close. I grew up in a suburb called Chula Vista, so very close to the border. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that it just seems like so for so long, immigration has been an issue, even in recent history, 20 or 30 years, and that there has been, right, increasing efforts to militarize the border, right, to establish fencing barriers, etc. And yet there's this similar, you know, kind of like myopia that, you know, continuously like intersects with American politics, where immigration politics itself is the constant, and concerns, you know, xenophobia, nativism, etc., are kind of this, you know, constant theme in American politics. But yet this kind of rediscovery by other, you know, parts of the American public that, you know, oh my gosh, immigration is an issue, and yes, we need to secure the border, or we need to build a wall. And it just seems like to me, you know, there's, I don't know what the exact processes of how many years this recurs, when it seems like there's this reawakening, and somehow some different region in the, you know, the United States becomes aware, you know, that they're or alarmed over immigration and that there should be a wall. But, you know, it just seems like there's this, you know, kind of constant paradoxical relationship between those two things. Immigration being the constant concern, right, of American politics, one of the primary ones, right? Certainly throughout the latter half of the 20th century, no doubt, but then also kind of this rediscovery of it as, you know, an issue, a space of concern, you know, the border as a space of danger, etc.
Right. I mean, in many ways, the wall is a product of an evolving set of concerns or fears, right? Today, the rhetoric is focused around the topic of immigration, right? There's the caravan coming, more reason to build the wall. The migration, immigration is a problem, more reason to build a wall. But if you go back just a few years, it's drugs, or it is terrorism, or, you know, there's this evolving set of political concerns that is a response to, well, I think it's, in a way, it's highly politicized, right? It's a physical manifestation of evidence that the government is doing something. So there, you know, near San Diego, there are the prototypes that were constructed by the Trump administration, these enormous 30-foot tall prototypes of future border walls that are put in place. And those have tremendous amount of power to excite those who are afraid, or those who are concerned that something is coming from the other side, and this is the solution.
Right.
And so, you know, to me, I completely understand the need for security. I think everyone does, but I think it's the politicization and the hyperbolization of the situation that both creates this almost hysteria, but creates a body of architecture. I call them architecture, that is equally as hyperbolic and hysterical.
Right.
And I mean that in every sense, every definition of the word.
Right.
They're funny, right? They're ridiculous to a certain extent.
Definitely, definitely. And I think that's one of the things that really fascinated me about your work is, you know, it's one of the first that I've read. You know, unlike many academics, I'm kind of, you know, really narrow into my discipline and whatnot, but I do try to read broadly outside of it. But to see an architect and a designer in particular, right, someone that's you know, trained and spends a lot of time thinking of infrastructure and thinking of buildings, right, thinking of how and why something is built, what's its practical or pragmatic purpose, etc., right? Can you talk a bit more about how your background, your training, both, you know, in academia and you know, as a professional, right, brings this view that you take to the border, to where, you know, you create this manifesto that is a thought piece, that is a protest against the wall, but at the same time, that is not just, right, you know, kind of lashing arguments against it, but actually promoting ideas. Some, you know, serious, some very satirical, as you mentioned, and hyperbolic, but others that could be, you know, promote much better use for the wall itself, accepting that we need security and that the wall itself is something that is there in stages and probably, you know, don't really see. At least I don't, the future of where there's not a wall, right?
Right. Well, it's been a challenge and a very difficult one for me to communicate through the skills that an architect has, which is making models and doing drawings, making visualizations of proposals, that the proposals would not, in fact, be proposals for the construction of walls, but they would be visuals, there would be ideas that would communicate to the world the reasons we do not need a wall. It's antithetical to what an architect does, right? I would say it's been difficult for me to think about how that's done, because I didn't want to go out into the borderlands with a picket sign saying no more walls. I completely respect everyone who's doing that. But I wondered how, you know, I don't have that luxury to do that. And I wondered how architecture could be a form of activism and how it would catalyze a conversation, how it would make people aware of what was happening, and that counter proposals, if we might call them that, aren't propositions for walls, but they're provocations of thought. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that any of what I'm proposing is a good idea for a wall, but what I wanted to make clear is that there are issues that affect the spaces in and around the walls that we should consider. And this is what I think architects' skills really, where their skills really lie. There's a famous quote, it says, architects do not design walls, but the spaces between them. It's attributed to this Egyptian architect, Hassan Fathi. And it's a beautiful quote to me. And it again speaks to what architects, I believe, are good at. It's not the designing of the walls themselves, but recognizing that walls have consequences and shape spaces, not only spaces that are dimensional, that are volumetric, but spaces where things happen, that bring people together, that create scenarios and events. And when you place a wall in the world, that it begins to shape that space around it. There's a consequence to every wall you place in space. It's very different when you place it between a bathroom and a bedroom, but it's also very different when you place it between a river and a deer, right? And so, what happens in these moments? What begins to occur when you place a wall between a rain cloud and a downhill slope of a hill? And these are the things that seem very small but have enormous consequences. So, when the wall was built, for example, one of the first rainstorms that occurred just simply washed against the wall. The rain had nowhere to go. Turned parallel to the wall and flooded a town. No one really thought about those dire consequences. People died in these floods. It was a rainstorm as a consequence of the wall itself, of the construction of the wall, and not thinking about that rain had to move across, the drainage, that there are watersheds. And so this became the challenge. The challenge, you know, wasn't for me to think about ways to make better walls, even though I think that's also a consequence. I would like to think that's a consequence of this, that if we do build walls, we should think very clearly about what the consequences are, about the migrations of animals, about the life of humans. I think that's part of the conversation. But I also think that we should think about what it means in the aftermath of a wall, if we do decide that walls should come down. And I think we should think about what it means to construct a wall in the landscape before we construct that wall, which I don't think there was a lot of thought about that. It was a kind of a relentless scenario in an imagined tabula rasa where, you know, this is just an open context and we just have to put a wall, not recognizing that when a wall cuts through a riparian landscape or through a wildlife refuge or through private property of farms, like what this all means and what the consequence. So this is the challenge for me, to not only be able to arrive at models and drawings that you know begin to catalyze this conversation, but also to be able to clearly communicate the intentions of the images in the book when it comes from an architect. I think architects have a responsibility to producing things and seeing them built. And they do that through drawings. And I'm shucking that responsibility a little bit. And I think that's confusing to some. Like, why would an architect make a drawing of something if he wasn't intending to build it? And I think that's in there lies maybe some kind of problem that needs to be grappled with. But it's not the real problem. The real problem is, how do we address this thing that we've constructed along our southern border and the consequences of it?
Well, and what I found as I've looked through the book itself and have read it and both taught it in a class and seen responses to it, what I've seen that the images really do provoke is a sense of imagination of really reconsidering, right, what is there, right, and what its purpose. And I think that's an incredibly powerful aspect, you know, of the book. I mean, some of the proposals are, again, they range from things that I think that actually could, you know, be implemented, and, you know, how politically feasible or not that is, you know, is a whole other question. But things that actually seem, you know, very well practical and pragmatic, and others that are, again, a bit more protest and satirical. But you know, the approach, you know, that design approach and using the images and the models, you know, I see as just, you know, incredibly powerful at promoting, you know, a rethinking, a critical, right, rethinking of the effects of having, you know, the wall there, right? And again, there's existing, like, what, 700 something miles of wall or barriers or barricades and, you know, fencing of sorts, you know, along what is a almost 2,000-mile border, right, international boundary.
Right.
Great. You've started to hint at this a bit, but I was wondering if you could maybe speak to it a bit more explicitly, and that is, what has been or what role have architects or did architects play, if any at all, in the existing, you know, those existing various types of fencing, barricades, and wall that is there, you know, as of today?
Yeah, really none that I know of at all. I mean, this has all been left in the hands of engineers, particularly the Army Corps of Engineers, and in some cases, private industry that also are comprised of engineers and security companies. There have been academic institutions involved and research institutions involved, like I mentioned Fence Lab in the book. But architects, none that I know of. There was, in around 2006, a call by the New York Times, which I mentioned in the book, to very famous architects to ask them what they would do on the wall. And the proposals really are wide-ranging in the categories. I talk not so kindly about one of them by the architect Anton Predock, who proposed that, oh, let's have Mexican laborers build it, and it will have an enormous hot plate that would, you know, burn people in the hot sun. And this Anton Predock actually wrote me later, and he said, "Well, I really apologize for that proposition." You know, and I think it was a very quick response. And some architects didn't offer proposals, and some offered proposals that were, you know, about energy. But I think what was problematic about that call and about those proposals is that it happened very quickly. I don't think that it was deeply studied. And at the time, it was a very, you know, the world was a very different place at that time in terms of the our evolving ethos. I mean, even for me, my own book, to me, exists at a different time in history. Mm-hmm. It exists prior to Donald Trump being the president, which is a very different world in my mind.
Right.
And so I would have to admit that while in many cases I'm trying to highlight that something is ridiculous through humor, and I don't know if I myself don't know if it's satire, irony, or poetry. Mm-hmm. But I'll be honest that I don't know yet. This is a thought process for me. But what I do recognize is that I might not think certain things are so funny anymore.
Right.
I think there's a seriousness to the world we live in now that it's hard for me to grapple with some of that work. I've attempted to define it in different ways, looking back upon it and realizing, oh, there was work done before the wall was actually constructed. There was work that was in response to the fact that we have a wall, and there was work in that book that is actually provocations that are proposals of resistance.
Uh-huh.
And more recently, I've been working on projects that actually go out back into the landscape and are realized and constructed. And this may be the next part of this work. How can we go back into that landscape and do something? And recently, this summer, in response to the child separation at the border, I took a sign that's very famous. It was in Orange County several years ago. It was put up by the California Transportation Department as a highway sign to warn drivers of people running across the road. And the people were immigrants who were being dropped off often on the highway by coyotes,
right.
And they would run across the road. And so the signs were put up as a caution,
right.
So that people would keep an eye out for them. And that this sign has a really interesting history, in that the sign was designed by a Native American war veteran graphic designer who worked for Caltrans and was really sensitive about the way he thought about the making of this sign so that it would call attention to people. He thought having a little girl with piggy tails,
right.
would be extremely important in giving people the kind of empathy for people crossing the border. And the profile of the father in that sign is the profile of Cesar Chavez. And what was interesting is that sign was perceived differently from the United States and Mexico. So from Mexico, the sign was sometimes a little bit offensive, but sometimes was confused as a place to cross.
Right.
Like a safe place to cross the highway.
Right.
And
yeah.
So signs facing south would say prohibido,
right.
prohibited to cross here. And signs facing north would say caution.
Right.
And so it took on a very different message. And so what I did with that sign was I simply reversed the position of the young girl running back to her family with her arms outstretched. And it's been placed on a billboard along a highway in I-95 now. And so hundreds of thousands of people are seeing this billboard now for a different political reason. And so I'm hoping to work on more projects like this.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate you bringing up that sign. It was, I grew up with that sign, being just within 10 miles of the border. And every time my family would head down to Tijuana, I remember the first time I see it, guy, it was just so shocking, to me as a kid. I mean, I was like 11, maybe 10 or 11. And I just, I keep trying to think of and remember what I felt. And I think so much of it was confusion. But it also, there's also kind of like this instant implication of, I knew, almost instantly who it was referring to, even though I knew nothing. Like, we'd moved down, my family moved down from Oxnard. And, again, another place with a lot of, Mexican American culture and Mexican American history of agriculture and et cetera. But, I'd not seen those signs before we moved down to San Diego. But it was just strange as I think back now that I almost instantly knew what kind of it was referring to. And you're right. It's kind of these signs have been, I don't know if any more exist along the freeway. I've heard that, and I read an article in the LA Times, I think about a year or two ago, that most of them have kind of been, taken or stolen as like kind of ephemera, and
right.
There may only be one more that's still on the freeway.
In a way, the work in the book, I made it to seem also as ephemera. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why they're in the form of snow globes and postcards and maps. There are these souvenirs that mark this point that we have to remember. And I thought, there are these events happening that are really interesting, that are a product of this time that is not, okay, with the optimism of the book, may not last much longer, right? That's the optimism of the book.
Right.
So we have to remember this moment, that we did this, that this happened.
Yeah.
And so that's the reason for the objects and drawings in the book to be presented as they are.
Right. And you're so right, that the book really did. I mean, people may get confused with the 2017 publishing date, but if they're those that are familiar with how long it takes to produce an academic work, right? And as you've explained, these things, these ideas were forming and this project was evolving, much before the contemporary moment where you're right, post 2016, post November 2016, right? the border has taken on a completely, not, I mean, not completely different, but there, you know, it's just another level, right? The stakes of, like you said, you know, discussing the border and in ways even, you know, joking about it almost kind of, right, seem like, wow, that's, we are in a different context to where things aren't so funny anymore, you know, about even discussing the wall itself. But yet I get so much of the message, and I think so much of it, I can understand how it'd be received by different people coming from different, well, geographic, right, and, you know, temporal context. Like, again, when the border itself, when their awareness about it and immigration as an issue emerges, that would just elicit so many different responses, you know, to the book itself. But very much, it does ring true to me that this does seem like a timepiece before this kind of additional level of craziness that we are currently in, right? And it would have just seems just so absurd, right, that, you know, I think that in 2017, 2018, if I would have thought about this maybe 5 years or so ago, that, you know, actually prototypes of, as you've mentioned, 30-foot concrete barriers were being built right along that wall, right? And much of that absurdity to someone with, you know, an experience in the borderlands, right, is the fact of understanding, right, the ineffectiveness of the wall and just how much of a waste it's been, right? And that, you know, government agencies themselves, particularly the Border Patrol, as you write about, right, that they realize that the wall itself is nothing but, you know, it buys them time, right? It's to delay that process. There isn't really any you know, confidence in the fact that the wall is going to stop a flow, right, of people, or it's going to stop the migration, but that it just buys the Border Patrol time, right?
Right. And if we think about the kind of evolving rhetorics or politicization of the wall as a response to issues, if we think about drugs, cartel love the wall. It's a way to organize their territories much more efficiently. Mm-hmm. So does it help there? No. Immigration into the U.S. is not really a problem. We have a net zero immigration to this country, and most of them do not come running across the border. So is it helping there? No. Have any terrorists ever been apprehended, and have the wall been helpful in that from the southern border? No. So then what does it do? And that's the question. I think there are certainly understandable questions about immigration and the separation between, like, the distinctions between countries. Those are understandable. I don't think borders are unnecessary. I think it's necessary to define territory. And I think what architects do is define territory. They define spaces. But recognizing in the 21st century that there are many kind of territories that overlap, right? I was just in El Paso the other day, and AT&T charged me for using Mexican cell phone service, even though I never went. Right? There's a territory there that's invisible and undefined. So to simplify it to a line in the sand is just not very sophisticated, right. I think. Yeah.
Yes, you know, and as you mentioned in the book, that the existing 700 miles of, again, fencing, barricades, and walls that exist, and I'm hoping I read this right, that the government agencies have placed the construction and maintenance of, you know, the wall post the Secure Fencing Act, right, at something over $49 billion over 25 years, right? Yeah. And so getting to some of the proposals in the book, right, and again, understanding that it is very much of a thought piece, but thinking of that figure, you know, virtually $50 billion over 25 years, what are some of the proposals and things that, you know, you allude to and point to in the book that you think actually could or would like to see implemented?
Sure. Well, you know, the borderlands are some of the fastest growing regions in both countries, in the United States and Mexico. And they are landscapes in need of clean water. They are some of the most energy-consuming landscapes in the country. And so as alternatives, I suggested things like infrastructure, wastewater treatment plants, for example, photovoltaic farm. These are things that other countries are doing that are far ahead of us. And these are the landscapes in which they would be the most efficient and useful. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a set of infrastructure that could be put in place that would be not necessarily in response to a security issue, but possibly. I mean, I mentioned in the book how these are often secure installations. Would these promote security in the borderlands? Possibly, but I also think that there's something about improving the landscapes in which one lives that makes those landscapes desirable for people to stay or invest in themselves. And I mean, when I go to Tijuana today, it's like one of my favorite cities. And what's happening in that city is it's vibrant culturally. There's an amazing music scene, amazing food scene, craft brews, beer scene. I mean, it makes me want to live in Tijuana because it's such an exciting city to be in. And I think that's because that city is investing in itself. Right? Mm-hmm. And there's probably a larger historical connection to people coming to the United States and investing back in that country as more a binational region, right? There's this trans border culture that moves back and forth that makes that place very rich culturally and intellectually and artistically. And so I just think that if we take that $50 billion and invest it in cultural projects along the border, I don't know if I mentioned this in the book or not, but think about there's something like 250 Seattle public libraries could be built across the border for that much. what are the most important cultural investment projects in the United States? Like the High Line, for example, you could build 500 miles of the High Line instead of 700 miles of border wall.
Right.
Like public parks, these kind of social infrastructures that we put in place that would make these regions more safe and more secure for the people living in them. That's my version of a beautiful future for the border, rather than a wall that certainly has its failures. That, you know, every single day people go out to the border with blowtorches and attempt to cut it down. And every single day border patrol agents go out with welding equipment and patch it up.
Right. Yeah.
That seems like not a smart kind of sustainable investment in security in my mind.
So true. So well said. Thank you for that. Well, I wanted to just shift as we get towards wrapping things up a bit. I appreciate your time. And give you a chance to talk a bit more maybe about other things that you're currently working on. You've alluded to that. You've alluded to some projects stemming off from this book, particularly during the current political climate. But so but what are some things that you're doing now after this book?
Well, on this theme, I mentioned reunite to think about how architecture can be more present as a form of activism in the landscape. And the book really made me aware and actually become friends with many of the artists that I feature in the book. And so I talk about the artist Ana Teresa Fernandez, for example, who went out to Playas de Tijuana and painted the wall sky blue to an amazing effect that the wall kind of, it really disappears. She erases it. And that's the title of the piece, Borrando la Frontera. And how impactful these kinds of operations are in communicating ideas, and they're realized, right? They don't exist on paper. They don't exist in model form. And so how can an architect participate in that? And so I'm attempting to find ways to think about doing that. And much of what I've done has existed in the art sphere. So like the sign, I've also produced a series of pottery objects called bad hombres, they're actually called bad hombres. Sorry. So when Trump said there are bad hombres at the border, I said, oh, they're not bad hombres at the border. They're bad hombres. And an hombre is a gradient between dark and light. So I used dark clay and light clay to make this pottery. And now we've taken this idea further and we're working with the University of Texas, El Paso, and their ceramics department, and ourselves and their students and their professors have gone out to various sites on both sides of the border, both Juarez and Tijuana, looking at the history of pottery production in that region, which has been ongoing for several thousand years,
right.
And we're producing a new set of objects made out of the local clays, earthenwares, that are bringing together these two landscapes, recognizing that it's one landscape, that there's traditions that are much longer. So working with people on the site, last week we were out there on a mesa overlooking Juarez, and we brought 3D printers out there, and we 3D printed Adobe with the students from UTEP, students from Texas Tech El Paso, professors, ceramicists, architects came. It just became a place of conversation about ideas around thinking about how we might make a new world using traditional technologies, looking both forward and into the past and talking about traditions and innovations. And so this kind of thing I'm working on now. I'm also working on looking at my borderlands in Colorado. And so I'm working with students from the University of Colorado Boulder and a professor there, Richard Saxton, and his art group M12. And we're working in my own home village, which my family has lived in for many generations, in my great-grandfather's adobe house, and building art in the landscape and thinking about life in that particular valley in Colorado as a present-day borderlands that still has the scars and the legacies and the future and the promise of what a border region can be.
Wow. Sounds like inspiring work, definitely. And thank you for sharing those projects in particular. I very much look forward to what continues to come out of your collaborations, and very much thank you for your time. I encourage our listeners to definitely get a hold of your book, take a look at it. It's a phenomenal piece. It's really, I think, beautifully presented, a very high quality gloss pages, images, just the right amount. I think of text and images, something that you can both, go back to and reflect to over and over again. And it can be used in a number of different settings. As I've said, I've taught with it. I've shared it. I was actually turned on to your book actually by my sister, who actually lives in New Hampshire, and she gave it to me as a Christmas present. I had no idea. Like I said, I'm always paying attention to fields a little bit more closer to my own. And so that's how I got it. And I just can't stop talking about it since I've gotten a hold of it. So thanks again for your time, and just again, phenomenal work.
Well, thank you very much, David, and I appreciate your support, and thanks.